Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Welcome to The Body Show. Each week we talk about health and fitness, but nothing replaces a visit to your own primary care provider. Heart disease, it's always up there as one of the top causes of mortality in the United States in both men and women, and yet sometimes this particular condition tends to present differently for men or women and at different ages and different risk factors. So today, to help us sort of demystify what's going on with the heart and what are the latest treatments for cardiovascular disease, I have Dr. Giselle Baquero from Kuakini Medical Center, and she is a cardiologist who's going to help us to understand why we should be so concerned about heart disease and what all of us can do every day to prevent having this be a major problem in our lives. Thank you for joining me on The Body Show.
Oh, no. Thank you so much for having me here.
Now, I remember way back in medical school, this was quite a long time ago, we were initially just starting to do some of the studies that were looking at the differences in the presentation of heart attacks for women versus men. And this was, boy, 30-some years ago that I was in school. And we were just now, at that time, looking to determine, is there really a difference in what that clinical presentation is? And nowadays, we're actually doing studies about it. So, why are we so worried about heart disease, and is it really that different in women?
Yes, so we should be very worried because it's killing us. It's killing
us
worldwide.
That's a good reason to be worried.
Okay. It's the number one killer of people worldwide, actually, not only here to us in the United States of America. But the reality is, and we learned this the hard way, is that it's killing women. It's killing both women and men, but women do poorly compared to men when we get heart attacks, when we get strokes. And I think a big thing is that women have not been included in any of the studies, any of the trials until just very recently. So we didn't know much about it, and we started to learn more about it in the last decade. But even with that, the amount that we know is still not enough. And we have the knowledge, but I don't think the public has it. And I think that's where we're struggling. We are really not doing well. We really need to educate, because we present differently, and that's why we're dying more. We're definitely different. We present differently. We do worse than men, and I think that's one of the biggest things why we still need to embrace, continue to study, continue to include women in these studies, because we gotta do something to change those numbers.
So let's start with some of the basic symptoms. So what we've heard about, and I'll sort of throw out there what I remember from school hearing about men and heart disease, it would be pressure in the center part of your chest, sometimes radiating to your left arm, maybe going up toward your jaw, and it would be a sensation that would occur with activity, and it might get better with rest. You may or may not feel a little nauseous, have a little shortness of breath, but in general, if you had chest pain, you'd feel it in your chest. That was sort of the classic way that you would hear about it in medical school, and this is what you would be concerned about. Chest pain, radiating, all those sorts of things. Now, that may be true for men. How is it different for women?
It's very different because we are divas. We present differently. We will not present with a typical, and there might be a small percentage that we still do, present with a pressure-like, elephant sitting on the chest type of chest discomfort. But we can present with the symptoms that we can attribute to something else. We can just have shortness of breath. We can only have just nausea, vomiting when we're trying to do something. The weirdest symptom that I ever got from a woman was just feeling cold. She was just feeling cold when everybody else was warm. And then one day it was so severe that she went to the emergency department. She was having an acute heart attack. She didn't have chest pain. She didn't have shortness of breath, nothing else. She was just really feeling very cold. So what I usually tell all my patients and their family members is that we know our bodies more than anybody. But we're also very resilient, and we have a tendency to be on denial because we have children. We kind of try to minimize symptoms. So what I tell all my patients is, if something is not right, especially when you're trying to do things, if you just don't feel that something is just not right, you're feeling tired, fatigued, short of breath, it's just if something is out of the ordinary, you just definitely need to seek for medical attention. Call your primary care doctor. If you have a cardiologist, call your cardiologist. Or if it's, you know, if it's really very frequent or is increasing in severity, just go to the emergency department.
Now, there might be differences in certain risk factors that individuals may have. So what are the classic risk factors that would make you concerned that somebody was truly having a cardiac event versus this may be something else?
So that's a very good point. And, you know, if you have any cardiac condition, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes is a big one. Anybody that has any inflammatory condition, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, or has had like very recently inflammatory conditions like COVID and you're having symptoms, you should definitely seek for medical attention. And smokers, cigarette smoking is a big contributing factor as well. People that have genetic conditions and they start to have these issues younger in age definitely should have very low threshold to seeking for medical condition if they're having symptoms.
So like a family history, if you know all of the, even if it's your uncles or your aunties or whoever it may be, they've all had heart attacks, then that might heighten your suspicion. Is there a particular age group where women tend to have a higher risk of having cardiovascular issues that they may not have had that same risk before?
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever, and this may vary in age because we are all different, but whenever we hit menopause, we completely lose our hormonal protection, our metabolism switches, and there is this known acceleration of cholesterol formation in our pipes, you name it, heart vessel pipes, neck pipes. So anybody that is reaching menopause should definitely, or had already reached menopause, should definitely start looking into first seeing a cardiologist, but also working into lifestyle changes, but being having low threshold for symptoms and being able to identify them early.
So see your doctor, get your blood pressure checked if you haven't, get your blood sugar checked, get your cholesterol checked, kind of know your numbers so you can then anticipate if you have to be particularly concerned about one of those areas. But don't let that stop you from doing some activity, exercise, watching your diet, getting out there, trying to stay healthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's it. We should be embracing those things very early in age, actually.
All right, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, and I'm here with Dr. Giselle Baquero from Kuakini Medical Center. When we come back, we're going to talk a little more about what happens if you do go to the emergency room and it is determined that you're having a heart attack. What happens next? We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Support for The Body Show comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Honolulu Waldorf School and Noheia Gallery.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, and I'm here with Dr. Giselle Baquero from Kuakini Medical Center. And we're talking about heart disease for both men and women, but particularly trying to make sure that we educate the women that some of your symptoms may be different than what you might be looking out for your other loved ones and or family members who might be from the male gender. And so you might just present with something a little different. We talked about fatigue, shortness of breath, denial, minimizing symptoms, a lot of things. You said right after menopause, sometimes there may be some changes physiologically that can put someone at increased risk, but also they may just be getting tired in general as they're getting older. So lots of reasons for people to know their numbers and get things checked out. Now, for men or women, if you present to the emergency room and it's determined that you're actually having a heart attack, there's different types of heart attacks and ways that we manage things. From the perspective of the patient, what's the first thing that might happen if it's determined, yes, this is a heart attack you're having, and what happens next?
So if this is an acute heart attack, the ones that we really need to rush, we are usually just going to rush them into what we call a cardiac catheterization, which is a lot where the main thing that we do is we're trying to get those heart vessels looked into and open. So the expectations are to get a procedure done. And the procedure is done fairly quickly because time is heart muscle. So we really try to get them in time because the whole purpose is to get from the time that they hit the emergency room door until the time that we're able to open up that vessel is the estimation is to try to do it within 90 minutes. So we explain things very quickly to the patient. We provide some medications that will help with, usually people are having heart attacks because there is a cholesterol plaque that ruptures and there's clot formation. So we're going to give medications to help delay or continuing or stop the accumulation of clotting. And then we go in with video-like-looking catheters through the wrist or the groin. Nowadays, we prefer to go through the wrist to reduce risk of vascular complications. We advance those video-looking catheters all the way until we reach the origin of the heart vessels, inject contrast, and that's where we identify the vessel that is blocked. And then we try to get it open. The way that we get it open is we go in with small, tiny balloons. When we balloon the vessel open, and then in order to try to keep the vessel from closing up on itself, we put little metal mesh that we call stents. And after that, you know, our main goal is to restore flow. So, and we can do that after we balloon initially, but sometimes if there is too much clot, we may need to do some other special procedures, like, you know, get a special catheter that will aspirate the clot. And, you know, there is a lot of other things that we can do in the process, just trying to make sure that we restore blood flow to that heart muscle.
Now, is somebody awake when this is going on?
Usually they're relaxed. So they're awake, but we give relaxing medications. If things get a little complicated and, you know, depending on where the heart attack is, some people may be very, very sick. And if we need to do some special things or utilize special equipment to try to help to keep the blood pressure going and these type of things, then we may sedate a little heavier. Some people may end up needing breathing tubes. It all depends on how they present. But usually, yeah, when you're having a heart attack, you're considered to be the sickest patient in the hospital.
And as you mentioned, time is heart muscle. So there's a time duration at which you really want to try and achieve opening up those blood vessels to try and bring that blood flow with oxygen to that area of the heart that is currently not getting the oxygen it needs. What are the consequences of a heart attack? So if someone comes in and you see them and you're able to put in a stent and open up the blockages, if it's longer than 90 minutes, if they've had this for the last couple of days or weeks, or if they just haven't come to the emergency room early enough, what else might you see during that catheterization that would let you know that, hey, this might have been going on for a while?
So more than in the time that we do the cath and we're taking pictures is when they present on that first EKG that we looked at. Nowadays, we have technology available that, you know, as we're getting the patient prepped, we can put an ultrasound real quick and look at the squeeze of the heart, how strong the squeeze is. But when people, you know, when there is a delay for us to, you know, or people to present to the emergency department or us to be able to open up those blood vessels, what the data has shown us is that people do poorly. They die more often, or they get more heart failure, they get more weakened hearts as a consequence of the heart attack. And that's essentially what we're trying to prevent.
So instead of having a normal pump, if they've had multiple heart attacks and maybe haven't had it addressed, they could have a problem with the pump. Instead of pumping out the amount of blood that it should, it'll pump out less, which brings out some other changes that could be negative for how long they live, really.
Yeah, absolutely correct. So we're all estimated. So we all have a normal pump function that is estimated. I'm just going to give some magic numbers there, 65%. So anytime anybody has a heart attack, the main concern is that squeeze getting weaker. And when the heart attack has been in an important vessel, sometimes the squeeze can get severely weakened. And then, you know, people's quality of life will definitely change after that. They can start to have heart failure, start visiting the hospital more frequently because they build up fluids, they have trouble breathing. And so this is why we really try to rush and try to get those vessels open, because everything we do is really trying to preserve the strength of the heart, of the pump.
So at that time of the heart attack, you may find, okay, there's a blood vessel and it's blocked and we're going to open that up. We're going to put in a stent. We're going to put someone on medications to try and help prevent any more arteries from getting involved. That'll usually include blood thinners for a while to keep the stent open. It may include cholesterol medicine. It may include blood pressure medication or diabetes medicine if it's appropriate for all those sorts of things. Now, how important is it, particularly for the blood thinners, that somebody is really careful in taking those regularly when they have a stent?
It's very important. So If you don't, and they're not necessarily blood thinners, but they're like a super aspirin type of medications, but they really help to the stent to heal well, and they really help to prevent more clot for forming inside of the stent. So if you don't take your super aspirin and your baby aspirin, then that stent can close up on you really quick, really fast, and give you an even bigger heart attack. So back in the days, this was very important. Nowadays, we have better generation stents that do a little better, and we can actually safely discontinue at least some of these medications if we need to. Still, the recommendation is to try to take them at least 6 months to a year. But if we need to, we know that is a little safer than back in the days to stop them for a surgery that needs to be done or anything that, you know, if the patient is having a bleed. So it can be stopped transiently for some time until things get controlled or the surgery get done. But then it is recommended to restart them. So it is very important that patients really take their medications every day, because that's what's going to keep that stent open.
Now, what if during the time that somebody is diagnosed with having a heart attack, you go in, you do a procedure to help open up the artery that's blocked, but you see that some of the other arteries in the same vicinity have a lot of blockages? Maybe they're not the one causing the heart attack right now, but boy, they look like they're getting pretty narrowed. What happens then?
So if depending on how much contrast we have used and on the kidney function of the patient, what the data has shown us is if we can get them open, the patient will benefit from getting them open. Now, we have to do this safely. So if the kidneys are not that happy, we can always stage it. So we take care of the heart attack blockage first, and then we either do it a couple of days later or bring them back after that hospitalization to get the others open. But we really try to address them as well.
And are there certain situations where someone might even find out they need surgery?
Yes, absolutely. So usually when you come in with a heart attack, we try to take care of the vessel of the heart attack. But if the other blockages are blockages that are vessels that have been closed up for a good while, and the patient is young, there are many things that we look into. They're diabetic, they're young, and it seems like they're going to benefit from getting bypass surgery on the other vessels, especially if one of the vessels that is involved is the widowmaker, but they come in with another vessel that is not the widowmaker giving the heart attack, then we just address the vessel with the heart attack and then we send them for surgery for the rest of the vessels.
So you mentioned something called the widowmaker. If you had to describe the different arteries of the heart to a layperson, how would you describe them?
So there are three main arteries. Two of them pretty much feed the left side of the heart or the pump of the heart, and is a mother vessel that divides into a big artery that feeds the whole front of the heart. And this is what people refer to as the widowmaker, and it's really called the left anterior descending coronary artery. But people refer to it as the widowmaker because when you come in with a heart attack in that artery, 50% of people will probably die from it. If it's right at the beginning of that vessel. Of course, we've gotten better with technology. We've gotten better on trying to get it open. But back in the days, the stats were very bad for people presenting with heart attacks on that vessel. Now, there is a branch that fits the side of the heart, and then there is another branch that fits the right pump of the heart. So those are the three main arteries that pretty much keep our heart pumping.
So you really don't want to have all three blocked.
Oh, absolutely. And we get humble on how sometimes patients come and they saying that, you know, they were doing perfectly well until this presentation, and we go in and take pictures and everything is blocked. And we really get humble on how much our body really adjusts and copes and hides these things. And you know, patients present when they're just very, very sick. And there is, you know, We try to give them options, but sometimes there are no options because everything is so advanced. And this is why we're really struggling and we're really trying to increase awareness.
All right. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. You're listening to The Body Show. I'm here with Dr. Giselle Paquero from Kuakini Medical Center. When we come back, we're going to talk some more about some of the ways that we can help reduce the risk of developing heart attacks. But if you have one, help make sure that you get what you need as soon as you need it, and hopefully help to preserve your heart function as much as possible. We'll be right back.
Support for The Body Show comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Ulupono Initiative.
Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, and I'm here with Dr. Giselle Baquero from Kuakini Medical Center. She is a cardiologist and an expert at helping people who have heart disease, particularly if they have a heart attack. So at the top of the show, we talked about what the symptoms might be for someone who might be a little different if they're women than men, but the classic reasons why people may want to go to the emergency room. We talked a little bit about what it might be like if they have to have a stent placed, if they have to have an intervention done at that time. Now, there are other situations where someone may not be having an acute heart attack, but kind of have some symptoms that suggest that although it's not happening right now, they're beginning to develop some troubles with activities. Where do stress tests fit into all of this? We know you should know your blood pressure, cholesterol, and sugar numbers, but should stress tests be done regularly? Should you only do it if you have symptoms? How does that help you to try and determine if someone is at risk for having serious heart problems and what they can do about it?
Well, stress tests are very helpful, especially when we're having risk factors and when we're having symptoms. So definitely I advocate for to all of our primary care providers and our family doctors when, you know, their patients are having risk factors and symptoms, would definitely try to get a stress test done because it's really helpful. That will increase, it won't tell us where the blockage is, it won't necessarily give us specific information, but it will increase our suspicion and will help us do the rest of the workup to determine if there are blockages in the heart vessels, if there is a blockage in the heart vessel causing these symptoms or not.
So if somebody has a stress test that's negative, okay, we know that's good. That means they can continue to do their usual exercise routine, hopefully keep themselves healthy overall. If they have a stress test that's positive, what happens next? They see you and...
Yeah. So that's a very good question because back in the days when we had an abnormal stress test, we usually will just try to get these patients to get a procedure done. So to see which vessel was the troublemaker and try to get it open. But there was a trial, I like to say recent, now it's been almost 5 years, the ischemia trial that really taught us a whole lot about how to manage patients with abnormal stress tests. And what we all learned from it is not only doing the procedure, but one of the most important things is making sure that we are... optimally managing blood pressure. We need to make sure the blood pressure is very well controlled. We need to make sure that we control symptoms. And if patients continue to have symptoms despite being on a good blood pressure regimen, despite being as maximized as possible on what we call antianginal, it really means just medications that will help to relax the heart vessels and help with symptoms, then at that point, there is definitely an indication for us to take pictures and try to see which vessels are blocked.
So if you don't pass your stress test, then it may be time to intensify what medications you're taking, specifically ones that'll help you if you have a lot of symptoms. But that doesn't necessarily mean you have to do a big procedure. So don't fear doing a stress test if you're worried that you're going to fail and it's going to take you down a different path. Make sure you get it checked because it may actually help your doctors to get you on medications that could prevent you from having that acute heart attack that brings you to the emergency room.
Yes, absolutely. Although there are some exceptions and because there are patients that were excluded from this trial, and anybody with a high-risk stress test result, then those patients, we still optimize medications, but we probably rush to doing the procedure sooner rather than later.
So what would those high-risk, would that be somebody who really doesn't do well on the stress test at all? I mean, sometimes you'll see these stress tests and you'll be like, wow, you did 7 or 8 minutes on that stress test. And I know by the time it hits like that 8 minute mark, you're really working on it versus somebody who in the first 2 or 3 minutes may not do well.
Yeah, exactly. If the blood pressure drops whenever you're getting very tired or getting to that peak exercise and we're all different, then that will be something to be worried about. Patients that don't last long, as you just said, you know, a couple of minutes and they're hopping and puffing and they start to have symptoms, then though all and of course, if they're big electrical changes on the stress test very early on, or life-threatening arrhythmias, those are the things that we consider high risk.
So the arrhythmia, why might that develop if somebody's having some blockage issues? Is it just because that's the heart's response to not getting the oxygen it wants?
Yes, correct. So the heart gets very irritable because it's not getting enough oxygen from, you know, not getting enough blood flow. So it just starts to throw, it gets irritable, start to throw it some arrhythmias, and some of those can be life-threatening.
Now, I recall hearing that the heart, you know, extracts, considering the amount of oxygen supply in your bloodstream, it extracts 95 to 98% of the oxygen that it's presented. So it's, you know, you don't have a lot of wiggle room there.
No.
And if you have significant blockages and you're not able to get enough oxygen, the heart's one of the first places that's going to clearly demonstrate some problems. Same thing for your brain. Your brain takes a lot of the oxygen from the blood that's presented to it as well. So that's another issue that people need to be considering. So when we talk about medication for optimizing, you mentioned antianginals. They tend to be medications that also help lower blood pressure. There's cholesterol medications. These days, I almost can't think of anybody who shouldn't be on some kind of treatment for cholesterol, but there's always these pluses and minuses about statins, and there's some newer medicines that have come out. What are some of the new approaches to cholesterol?
So there are some newer medicines, but statins remain the gold standard. And the reason is there's very few medications that have proven, aside from lowering cholesterol numbers, they have proven a benefit in surviving. So those medications that can prolong living and reduce heart attacks and reduce strokes, we try to embrace them, and they're part of our guidelines. So we really try to get people to understand the why, and they should continue to be on them, because a lot of misconceptions are, you know, oh, my cholesterol numbers is normal now, so I can come off the medication. And there is more to it, and some of these things we may not necessarily understand quite in detail the reasons why, but there's have some anti-inflammatory properties that definitely help to stabilize those cholesterol plaques, and they have proven to reduce heart attacks and strokes as well.
And if you don't tolerate one, there's a bunch of different statins available. So you can be on a different type of a statin, a different dose. If at all you can tolerate it, that seems to be one of the best medicines for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like blood pressure medication. So people may react to one, but not to another. And it's a trial, and it's kind of trial and error type of thing when you don't tolerate one. It's a patient's game, but we try to see if you can tolerate a different one.
And even if your cholesterol is normal when you're on it, that's not a sign to stop it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Especially if you had a lot of risk factors, if you have diabetes or have demonstrated have heart vessel disease.
All right. Well, we are going to stomp out heart disease right here in the islands. I want to thank you, Dr. Giselle Baquero from Kuakini Medical Center, for sharing your expertise with us today on The Body Show.
Oh, no. Thanks so much for having me.
All right, if you'd like to hear this show again, you can click on hpr.org. Follow the links to The Body Show. You can also find us on the HPR app. Our engineer is David Chong. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. We'll be right here next week, as we are every week, trying to help educate folks about ways to stay healthy and well, right here in the islands, every Monday at 6:30. We'll see you then.